Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
It's only February. We've already seen the US attack Venezuela, the kidnapping of the country's president, the Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney declaring rules-based order a fiction, and the war in Ukraine continuing into its fifth year with no end in sight. Meanwhile, US forces are amassing in the Persian Gulf, weighing up whether to attack Iran. It's hard to believe we're not even 2 months into 2026. We thought it was about time to get our resident geopolitical expert, Dr. Ben Zala, back. Ben's a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Monash Uni. He's going to be my guest every couple of months to talk geopolitics. Hello, Ben. Welcome back.
Hi, Suzanne. Thanks for having me back on.
Busy time for you geopolitical types, right? You've got something to look at everywhere, every moment.
It sure has been. We were only a couple of days into the new year before the phone started buzzing with media requests about the attack on Venezuela.
Yeah. So, look, just going back to that snippet of Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney's speech at the Davos Economic Forum, when we talked to you a couple of times last year, you had talked to us about the return of great power rivalry. And Mark Carney's speech really highlighted this new era we're operating in now, where the rules-based order seems to be disappearing, if you know, maybe weakening, perhaps disappearing. How much of that do you think is down to the actions of US President Donald Trump?
Yeah, so look, in that particular speech in Davos, Carney didn't mention Trump specifically and didn't really talk about the United States in a very pointed way, but everyone knew what he was talking about. It was the elephant in the room. And remember, at the time, in the lead up to that meeting, President Trump was speaking openly about wanting to annex Greenland, so territory from a NATO member, which of course is Denmark. And so there was this feeling that what he was really doing was taking stock and saying the way that we used to think about the global order, we just need to stop doing so. We just need to take it out of our minds. It doesn't exist anymore. In fact, he went so far as to call the so-called rules-based order a fiction. And this was a really important speech because it was from a Western leader. I think it's fair to say, had someone from the global south, so from the developing world, said this, it would have been less surprising, less shocking. Plenty of leaders from the developing world and plenty of analysts, pundits, journalists, activists, whatever, have said for a long time that this idea of a rules-based order, that everything is done by the rules and everything is fair and egalitarian, is a bit of a fiction. You powerful states get to throw your weight around when and how you choose to. So the fact that the Canadian Prime Minister was saying this really made us all sort of sit up straight and listen, because it's not the kind of language you normally get from Western leaders.
Now, on the SMS, I've got someone saying, I'm not sure if rules-based order was ever that strong. Was it, Ben?
Yeah, look, that's a really, really good point, and I tend to agree. I think this idea of the rules-based order, as if it's this thing that's out there in an objective sense, that there was this order where everyone played by the rules and you had the odd sort of deviation away from that at the margins, I think is a little bit of a fiction. I'm with Mark Carney on this. If you think of recent events, I mean, as we said, the year opened with the United States conducting an unprovoked military attack against the capital of Venezuela and kidnapping at gunpoint the president and his wife from their bedroom and taking them off to the United States to face a trial over there on charges. It's basically saying that this foreign leader has broken US law. If we think of last year, when Israel and then the United States joined in again, an unprovoked attack against Iran, no matter how we feel about the Iranian regime or the rights and wrongs even of that attack, it was unambiguously illegal. Iran is a signatory to the United Nations Charter, which gives it the right not to be attacked by other member states. And even if we go back to, you know, really important and very controversial episodes that even include Australia, things like the Iraq invasion of 2003, that was an episode in which the United States and a small group of allies decided that they had to engage in a military attack again against a sovereign country without the authorization of the UN Security Council. That would have been playing by the rules. That would have been the rules-based order sort of kicking in. And the US and its allies, including Australia, were very happy to put rules to the margins and say, we're going to engage in this military action anyway. So the idea that there has been this perfect rules-based order and suddenly now it's under challenge is a little bit inaccurate. It's always been rules for the power for the less powerful, and those who are more powerful get to choose when they adhere to those rules.
Mm. Well, the thing is about rules, Ben, that they don't really work if no one is going to enforce them. So, for example, when those Western countries all joined forces to invade Iraq, who should have stopped them under the so-called rules-based order?
That's right. And that's where you get to this question of, is it really a rules-based order? Are there rules at the heart of this order? Or do we have a global order which includes rules, and lots of rules are maintained and abided by every day? The sort of, as it were, the standard operating procedures of international politics is actually playing along with lots and lots of rules. But rules really only matter when you have a clear incentive to break them, and then something stops you. Either someone else, either someone enforcing those rules, or your own commitment to the rules-based order. So if you think about a rules-based society where we live, you know, if you get to a traffic light and you are stopping at the red light because that's what it says, the rules tell you that's what you're meant to do. If you're not at that light, during peak hour traffic, in which just driving through the intersection would be a very bad idea because you're driving to oncoming traffic, right? But if you're there at 3 a.m, and there's no traffic, there'd be nothing to stop you doing it. You wouldn't be endangering yourself. You wouldn't be endangering anyone else. And maybe you've got a really good incentive to drive through that light. Maybe, you know, you're driving to the hospital in a real hurry. That's the test. Now, do you sit there and wait for the light to go green because that's how the rules work and the rules apply to everyone all the time? Or do you think you've got a really good incentive and you're going to break them? And the thing is, in international politics, every state that breaks the rules always thinks that they have a really good reason for doing so.
Dr. Ben Zala is here. He's a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Monash University. If you've got any questions for Ben, we're looking at, you know, the geopolitical world order, I guess. Andrew in Otford's got a question. Evening, Andrew.
Oh, hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call. I just wondered, with this latest invasion of Venezuela and the kidnapping of the president and his wife, I would have thought that the larger countries like Britain or France, etc., even Australia would rise up and say, look, that's not on, because it's just not on. And now that I see it's really affecting Cuba as well, it seems like he's going to kill two birds with one stone, and also it's very financially beneficial, gleaning all that oil for his multinational companies that reside in America. I'm just sort of like a bit shocked that no one has stood up and said something or done something about it.
So, Ben, I think really the question is, look, what do you make of the, I guess, non-reaction, as Andrew would have it, from the rest of the world about what's happened in Venezuela?
Yeah, look, I think it's a really good point, Andrew. Certainly lots of reactions from other parts of the world. But as you say, most of the US allies, and that includes our own country, we were sort of deathly silent when this took place. There are many of us who sort of think, look, if you have a genuine commitment to the rules-based order, as our own government, for example, says we do repeatedly, this is what I mean by it's the moments when it's challenged is actually when you have to stand up and say, look, this was our ally. It's okay that we have disagreements with our ally. We don't agree with them on absolutely everything. And on this particular occasion, we think they got this one wrong because it is against the rules. And if every state in the international system is suddenly going to be invading their neighbours when they deem fit, well, then this is going to be a pretty chaotic international system. This is not what we're looking for. But Australia chose not to. Most Western states stayed fairly quiet and just said that they were, used the usual diplomatic language. They were monitoring the situation, called for calm, this sort of thing. And it's really because it's the United States that's doing it. It's the major state that is so powerful in the world that many states are still trying to figure out how do they deal with the Trump administration? How do they avoid the worst of his wrath, you know, in relation to tariffs and things like that? And ultimately, that's what they're more interested in. And this tells us that that commitment to the rules-based order, it might be quite a nice rhetorical commitment. We might like to say that we believe in an order based around rules, but when it's challenged by our mate, we don't do an awful lot about it. And the point about Cuba, I think, is a really, really good one. It does sort of feel like Cuba may well be next. There's no secret that effectively regime change in Cuba is a key goal for the US Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, Marco Rubio. He is a very, very important player in terms of shaping US foreign policy right now. He's really one of the most important US foreign policy shapers since someone like Henry Kissinger. And only Kissinger and Rubio have both held the roles of Secretary of State, which is their foreign minister, and National Security Advisor at the same time. And part of sort of tightening the screws on Venezuela and then ultimately engaging in a form of regime change in terms of removing the leader was all about putting pressure on Cuba, because Venezuela was Cuba's major sort of sponsor, major ally, and was particularly important to Cuba in terms of selling oil to it. And Venezuela is now not able to sell any oil to Cuba at all. And so it does feel like the US is trying to increase pressure on Cuba and see if they can sort of create an uprising from below and see if they can topple the regime there. So we may see more in the United States' immediate region in Latin America over the coming months.
Andrew, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
All right, good to talk to you. There's Andrew in Oxford. So, Ben, you mentioned that we've Australia released all that diplomatic language monitoring the situation. What do you imagine, you know, Penny Wong and Anthony Albanese are saying in private? What do you imagine the response is?
Look, there's no doubt about it. It puts them in a bind. It puts countries like Australia and other states like the UK, like lots of Western European states, in a really, really tricky position. Because the US is our ally. We have ensured through various decisions over decades now that we are incredibly reliant on the United States, not least in terms of our defence policy. AUKUS is the most visible example of this, but that's, AUKUS really is only the tip of the iceberg. And that means that there is a limit to how much the Australian political leaders or other Western leaders really want to criticise what the Trump administration is doing right now. That doesn't mean that they can't. And in fact, that was part of the point that Mark Carney was making, the Canadian Prime Minister at the World Economic Forum. He was saying, look, us middle powers, we really need to band together. So he was saying the idea of the rules-based order out there that is defended by the powerful states like the US is a bit of a fiction. But he wasn't saying the rules-based order is a bad idea. In fact, he was saying the opposite. He's saying it's a great idea. Rules will help protect us weaker countries, but it'll only exist if we defend it, if we fight for it. And he was saying us middle powers really ought to show some solidarity and get together and push back against this erosion of the rules-based order, not just by the United States, including by other, you know, more powerful or states that are becoming more powerful, like China, like Russia. And he was saying it's time we got serious about those rules, and that would mean criticising the major powers when they play fast and loose with those rules.
So if we go back to Venezuela, Ben, what has been the fallout of that move, and what does all this mean for US relations with its immediate neighbours? I mean, who are its friends in Central and South America?
Look, it does have some, depending on your definition of friendship, of course. I mean, the reality is the United States is the major regional power there, right? I mean, the United States is the most powerful country at the international level in the world. It's certainly so in its own region. And it's not unusual for the neighbours of a great power to basically choose among a couple of different options that really boil down to either keeping your head down, trying not to be noticed, or cozying up with them, or every now and again, it's looking for some sort of outside sponsor in terms of backing up your resistance to that regional power. And Venezuela really was probably the most vocal or the most obvious state that was really pushing back against US power and was very critical of US foreign policy. But it's not that there aren't other critics across the region. Various leaders across Latin America will fairly regularly criticize US foreign policy, but they're all now fairly nervous because they've just seen what happens to the leader of a state that gets in the sights of the Trump administration. And I think what's changed recently is, for the last sort of certainly 20 years or so, the US has really been focused on its role in the world more broadly, and particularly focused on areas of the world like the Middle East, like Central Asia. So you think of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and so forth, the war on terror years, all of that. And it's fair to say there's been a little less focus on Central and South America. That's certainly a part of the world that there was much more focus on during the 60s, 70s and 80s. And you can think of various controversies in Panama and Nicaragua and so forth. And it really does look like Washington's sights are turning back home to its immediate region. So I think most Latin American countries now are much more wary about their relations with the United States and are thinking much more carefully about how or how much they push back against US power and whether they want to fall on the wrong side of the Trump administration.
You said the US is the most powerful country in the world, and I know this to be true because we're always hearing it. But what is it exactly, Ben, that makes it so powerful? Is it money? Is it weaponry? What is the key to that?
It's a really good question, and I think the answer is probably something like all of the above. The US has been and continues to be one of the major economies in the world and an economy that sits right at the heart of the global trading system. So one of the things that we're seeing from the Trump administration is a much greater propensity to use the fact that all these countries around the world are economically dependent on the United States as a point of leverage. So you think of the use of tariffs and so forth. Militarily, there's no doubt the United States is the preeminent power in the world. There are other important military players, China, Russia, to an extent, India, a couple of others in their own regions, for example, Western European states, Britain, Germany, France. But the United States is really the only state that can project serious military power in all regions all the time. And also part of it is what we call soft power. So some of it is about the cultural influence of the United States through, Hollywood films and music and all these sorts of things, the kind of softer side, which is really more about attraction rather than coercive power or anything like that. And there's also this sense that the United States has been at the heart of the global order now for decades. It was one of the major protagonists during the Cold War, one of the two superpowers. And then when the Cold War ended and eventually the Soviet Union collapsed, the United States was really the only superpower left standing. So there is this sense that the global order has been built around the United States or around US power somewhat. And that doesn't just peter out easily. Even with the rise of new powers like China and the re-emergence of Russia and the kind of slower growth, but now it's quite impressive growth of India, that means that the US isn't the only game in town, but US power has a sort of a staying power, as it were. It's really deeply embedded into the international order, and that comes down to its military, its economy, the size of its population, the dynamism of its society and its economy and its education in terms of its tertiary education sector. It's still a destination point for those sorts of things. It really is a state that you can't avoid in international politics.
Now, on the SMS, Dave's just saying, look, oil's always been a source of conflict. We have to find a viable alternative, such as solar power. And Donald Trump wants oil companies to invest in Venezuela after the removal of Maduro. How is that going?
We don't have lots and lots of details as yet. It was one of the really striking points when the US attacked the capital, Caracas, and engaged in this sort of lightning strike with special forces to whisk away or kidnap, really, the president and his wife, that straight away President Trump was talking about getting US oil companies back into Venezuela. They'd been effectively kicked out over a period of time or been asked to operate in ways that suited Venezuela because, hey, it was their oil, it's their sovereign territory, and those oil companies didn't want to do so, and so many of them had left and so forth. And so Trump was speaking instantly about he wanted to get big oil companies back in, and he sort of oscillated between, on the one hand, saying this will be part of building back up the Venezuelan economy, saying almost like we're doing a favour to Venezuela in doing this, and on the other hand, saying it's basically our right to do so, they owe us, and so forth. It's fairly sort of straightforward, brazen language around that. So oil is certainly part of this. I think the larger part there is about where Venezuela was selling its oil to, because I really do think Cuba is sort of part of this multi-step play that Marco Rubio is trying to orchestrate here. So I think oil is right at the heart of it, but it's perhaps less about making lots of money from Venezuelan oil. That's an added bonus. It's more about ensuring that Venezuela wasn't selling its oil to countries that the United States didn't want it to sell it to, like Cuba.
Well, I understand, though, that some of the oil companies are actually saying not so keen to go invest in Venezuela. It would still be risky, wouldn't it?
Yeah, look, some of them have had their fingers burnt in the past where they've made investments and then Venezuela's changed its mind about how it wants to structure its oil sector, which of course it has every right to do. Any investment is always a risk, right? And so lots of those oil companies will be looking at the offers made from the Trump administration and saying, well, we have been there before and things didn't always work out and you are taking some fairly unprecedented steps here. We may just want to see where this all lands so far, where it all lands in terms of what's the regime going to be like in Venezuela, how stable is it going to be, are you really going to be committed to Venezuela's long-term economic future or is your attention going to turn elsewhere? So I could imagine being an American CEO of an oil company and being a little wary about going into this particular venture.
Dr. Ben Zala is here, a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Monash University. Graham in Perth. Evening, Graham.
G'day, Suzanne and Ben. My question is, do the major powers take any notice of the United Nations anymore?
Hi, Graham. Yeah, very good question. Mixed answer on this one, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that the United Nations is set up in a way that the major powers really have a disproportionate influence within it, particularly in relation to the permanent membership of certain states, of five countries in particular, of the UN Security Council, which is the only body within the UN that can authorise the use of force. Now, as we know, the major powers sometimes just ignore that and go and do so anyway. But sometimes the UN is basically a conduit to those major powers throwing their weight around. So when it suits them, yes, and in all sorts of ways. But when it doesn't, they routinely ignore the United Nations. The United Nations, we always have to remember, isn't a world government. It's an intergovernmental organisation. So in other words, it's made up of nation states who are all the member states. They're all the sovereign states, and there is no UN without those member states. If we all withdrew from the UN tomorrow, there'd be some very nice office buildings and some staff with nothing to do. There's nothing above the nation state. So there's nothing that stops a powerful country saying, I'm going to take this military action or whatever it is anyway and ignore the United Nations unless enough of them are going to band together and do something about it. So the Russians have ignored the UN in terms of the invasion and subsequent war against Ukraine. The US has ignored the UN in terms of strike on Iran, strike on Venezuela, as I mentioned, going back to things like the invasion of Iraq. States like Israel have ignored the UN in terms of its actions in Gaza, its strike on Iran and so forth. So it's a sort of a mixed bag. The United Nations is effective in various areas in terms of helping states to cooperate where it's in their interests, but it doesn't have that enforcement mechanism. It doesn't have power that's anything bigger than the more powerful nation states.
Mm. Graham, any follow-ups or does that answer your question?
It just raises more fear within me. After 72 years, I keep seeing the same thing daily around the world. It just keeps the saber rattling every day.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks, Graham. And Ben, I mean, I was wondering too, I mean, do you fear for the long-term future of the United Nations, if indeed you do think that it is an important global body, if we continue to see the kind of geopolitics that we are seeing at the moment and more figures like President Donald Trump in the US, do you think that, you know, the United Nations could overstay its welcome?
Look, absolutely. All international organisations come and go. There's nothing that says the United Nations has to last forever. In fact, the longevity of the United Nations, you know, being in existence since 1945, is a little bit of an anomaly. If you think of its predecessor, which was the League of Nations, it only lasted a couple of decades. And in fact, it wasn't even really functioning fully for those couple of decades. So the fact that the UN is still with us is a good sign. It shows that it is a fairly robust organization and that it is in the interests of most states most of the time to have this thing to help sort of oil the wheels, as it were, of global cooperation on all sorts of issues. But I don't think we should take it for granted. And ultimately, the United Nations can become ineffective. It can become gridlocked, deadlocked, as it were, and not be serving the interests of states around the world. It is worth remembering that the United Nations has survived previous periods of intense great power competition. It survived the Cold War between the US and the Soviet Union. And at various times, both the US and the Soviets circumvented the UN, ignored it, so forth. But the UN endured because it was in the interests of most states to keep this thing together. And even at various times, the interests of the Soviets and the Americans to keep it there as well. So I think it can survive another era of intense great power competition, but I don't think we should be complacent about it.
Someone on the SMS wants to know, please, Ben, what is the definition of a superpower?
Oh, that's a good question. And I've got an awful academic answer for you. There is no one objective definition. I'd love to give you that one liner and say it's X and that's what it is. The reality is a superpower is what we make it to be. It's what we decide it is. If you and I and everyone else perceive that, and I'm going to pick a country at random here, at Thailand is really a superpower for whatever reason we think it is, well, then effectively it is, because we will start treating Thailand as a superpower, and therefore it will be. There's no objective measure. There's no sort of list of countries around the world that are great powers, superpowers, regional powers. All these things come boil down to ultimately to perception. The reason we use that term superpower, the reason it sort of came about during the Cold War, was there was a feeling that the old term of major power or great power, which was to denote certain states who were just bigger and more and stronger and have greater sway in international affairs than the rest of the international system, that this term wasn't quite enough when it came to the Americans and the Soviets. That now that it was down to these two states that were so disproportionately powerful than everyone else. And part of that was material things like their economies. Part of it was about their militaries, particularly their nuclear arsenals and so forth. But part of it was just how we perceived these two states as being the most important, the most powerful states in the international system. And so that terminology has sort of stuck around a little bit. After the end of the Cold War, we tended to talk about the US as the only superpower left because it was just so much more powerful than anyone else, than its nearest rival. Now that we have China rising up the ranks and Russia seems to have re-emerged, and as I said, India sort of following close behind, there's a few others as well that might be sort of waiting in the wings. We tend to, we're sort of reverting back to that language of great powers a bit more. It does feel like we're heading back to what we call a multipolar system where there's multiple poles of power and there'll be multiple great powers. It'll probably be a little more familiar to us. If we think of something a bit like the World War II era, where there was Britain, France, Germany, the US, Japan, Russia. It does feel a bit like we're going back to that sort of a system in which you don't really have states that you think of as superpowers, that they're so much more powerful than everyone else, but you do have this small group, this sort of coterie of great powers.
I've got lots of interesting questions coming in. I don't think we're going to get time to take them all. I might address Sue's question, which I think is quite interesting. How do you decide when to refer to a country's government as a regime instead of simply a government? I mean, what the word regime does seem to connote some kind of, well, it's not a good thing, certainly, the way that that word is used, right?
Usually yeah, you don't want to be referred to as a regime.
a dictatorial regime. Yeah, and we often regime change. How do we use that word? Why do we use it that way?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. And really, really good to pick up on that too. And it's something that, I mean, I'm guilty of it all the time. You kind of fall into that trap of describing certain governments around the world as a regime, but not other ones, right? And you're right, I think, Suzanne, we tend to associate it with authoritarian regimes, authoritarian governments. There we go, I'm doing it already. So states that aren't democratic systems, that are different in whether they're a theocratic system or it's a one-party state or whatever it is, you often refer to them as regimes because you're really talking about the kind of mode of government there as opposed to who happens to be in power at any one time. And you tend to use it when we're referring to governments where you have less change in the leadership, generally speaking. Not always. So, for example, people often talk about the Iranian regime. And when we're doing that, that doesn't mean that they don't hold elections or that they don't have changes in the leadership. But what we're saying is that there's a particular set of elites who are in power, and that's those around the kind of theocratic, powerful individuals in Tehran. And then there are the sort of political elites that are part of that as well. And that, as a collective, we think of as the regime. But the regime might be more than just the leadership, might be more than just the president or the prime minister at any one time. But you're exactly right that we tend to use these terms to denote authoritarian countries. And when we talk about regime change, that really is an attempt by an outside state, by an external state, to basically topple a government. So regime change, we should always note, regardless of whether in various examples you might have some sympathy for the goal of regime change in relation to a particular country, it is always illegal to just go into another country and use force or use more clandestine methods, using intelligence service and so forth, to try and change the government. It's an illegal action, regime change, but it is something that does happen around the world and it has a long history.
Yeah, I'm actually, Owen on the SMS is just saying, you know, come on, Maduro was a guy who butchered many thousands of Venezuelans. That's not up for debate, I don't think. Really,
That's right.
The way that this was carried out and whether one country has a right to go into another country and to, you know, kidnap the president. Anyway, look, Ben, I think with the questions that are flooding in on the SMS, we probably could stay here for another hour, but I will let you go. And thank you very much. And we'll get you back in a couple of months to talk geopolitics again with us.
Lovely to be with you. Thanks for having me back on.
Dr. Ben Zala is a senior lecturer in politics and international relations at Monash University.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.